The historical account of Joseph is so impressive that it creates a legend status. But his story is no fairy tale, folks. It is the Genesis account includes no mere speculation. Every word is true, proving the statement which has often been made, truth is stranger than fiction. Beyond that, the Joseph account is more than a rags-to-riches story. It is more than a thrilling drama of how a man overcame tragic adversity, rising from the dungeon to the throne of the world's greatest contemporary empire. Truly, it is all of this, but it involves a complicated storyline involving multiple individuals and showcases God's covenant, His sovereign plan in the development of His specially chosen nation. The Abrahamic covenant is not only referenced frequently in this brief history, but it also flashes prominently in the multiple scenes as the plot develops. Ultimately, this marvelous story presents a thrilling prophetic drama picturing the coming Messiah, who also rose from a dungeon-like setting, entered this world planet as a lowly human, became a servant and betrayed by someone close to him, endured the dungeon life of our sin-cursed world, and will soon return as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. As Pharaoh highly exalted Joseph from his dungeon cell, so God has highly exalted Jesus that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Let us walk through the entire Joseph story this evening to observe these wonderful details. Let's begin with the human plot where his life starts in chapter 37 of Genesis, and this is marked by treachery. The human plot is treacherous. There's a dubious setting in the location in verse 1 is the land of Jacob, his father. It's highlighting already at the very beginning the land. I hope you're circling that word land as you read your way through the book of Genesis because it's so important. It's not only the land of Jacob's his father, it's also called the land of Canaan. He's 17 years old. And he's a tattletale in verse 2. He tells on his older brothers. They're doing bad things. He comes back. He gives a report to dad about it. His parental errors, he is surviving. Just like Jacob was the product of parental errors, being a favorite child, he also favors a favorite child. And it's Joseph. He gives him the coat of many colors. And so his brothers hated Joseph, it tells us in verse 4, because of father's favoritism. That's the biggest reason why they hated him. So when you think about the plot of Joseph's brother, don't pin it all upon the brothers. Dad had a part in this because of his errant parenting. Then there's the dream scenes. In verses 5 through 11, Joseph has a dream, his sheaf stands up straight and his brother's sheaves bow down to him. And they say, what do you think? And they interpret this. They got the interpretation right. What do you think? You're going to rule over us? Come on, you little brat. You're the squirt in the family. That's not going to happen. Then he has another dream. Verses 9 through 11, the sun, the moon, the 11 stars. It says specifically the 11 stars bow down to him. The sun and the moon and the 11 stars, those are his 11 brothers. And mom and dad are told this story. And even his father now rebukes him. Jacob rebukes him for this. What are you trying to say here? Don't you understand? I'm the father. The father doesn't bow down to the son. The son should be respectful to the father. So he rebukes him for his dreams as if Joseph could control his dreams, right? Stop having those bad dreams, Joseph, all right? I don't know. Parents, don't do that to your children. If they have bad dreams, try to comfort them and encourage them and maybe be careful on your interpretation of them. But it's interesting In Revelation 12, verses 1 through 4, we find the same scene kind of alluded to that very clearly shows us this is referring to the nation of Israel. The sun and the moon and the 12 stars, those are considered in that setting the nation of Israel. So then we come to the death scheme that they give. The location in verses 12 through 17, it's remote. That's the key. You don't have to worry about Dotham, where that is or so on. It's just a long ways away from home. Dad could not protect his son at this point. The initial plan was murder. Let's kill him. Let's get rid of him. They intended to kill him. Does this not sound like Cain? Does this not sound like Esau? Does this not sound like the devil's scheme for what he is? Jesus said in John 8, he was a murderer from the beginning. Anyone that says kill, murder, is of the devil. Well, one of the sons, one of the brothers didn't like that, so we have what I call some substitute plans. He wanted to stall them, so he says, no, don't kill him right away. Let's just throw him in a pit and think about this a little bit. And Reuben intended to go back and rescue him. But in the meantime, Reuben's off shearing sheep or gathering flock or something, and his brothers see a group of Ishmaelites coming through. Ishmaelites, the other son of Abraham, distant relatives coming through, and you would think that cousins would treat each other better than this, but they sold this young man, Joseph, into the hand of these Ishmaelites. They said, let the Egyptians kill him. Let somebody else do the dirty work that we don't want to do. They got rid of that bratty brother that they didn't like. And then there's the deceptive simulation. How are we going to deal with this? We got to tell Dad something. So they took his coat and they dipped it in blood from one of the sheep. They probably ripped it up and scrubbed it on the dirt, made it look like it really was an attack by a wild animal. And so they come back and they show that coat to Dad. They were being deceptive. Isn't it interesting how deception runs in this family? Deception started with Abraham, who he lied, and his son Isaac lied, and Jacob became the great deceiver against his brother, and now it shows up again. It is coming back to haunt Jacob, and he spends years mourning the loss of a son that didn't really die, all because of a lie. So we've got human plot, treachery. You think about this story, it's just really hard to understand. I grew up in a family with 12 children. There is no way I would have allowed any of this kind of thing to happen in my family. How could any family member do this to a brother or even a sister? Now, the next chapter is a hard one to swallow. It's hard for us to understand here. It's like the last word, notice the last verse in chapter 37. It says in chapter 37, verse 36, and the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. So we got Joseph all the way down into Egypt, and he's now been sold to this guy, and he's kind of in charge of a prison. Now I want you to look at the first verse in chapter 39. Skip chapter 38 for a second and come to 39. In 39, verse 1, it says, and Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard of Egypt, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. So it's like, it's just picking up and continuing the story as if chapter 38 wasn't even there. So why in the world does Moses include it, and does God want it included in the inspired text? We'll call this chapter human perversion, transgression. It shows the depravity of man. There are casual choices in verses 1 through 6, and this is a story primarily about one of the sons, and his name is Judah. Now, we're very familiar with the tribe of Judah because this is the tribe from which Christ came. But oh my, what a horrible, sullied background in this family and in this tribe. This man is depraved. Casual choices at the beginning. He marries an unbeliever in verses 1 to 2, which is a dangerous thing to do. It's a terrible thing to do. He raises godless sons in verses 3 through 6. The verse give a quick summary of several years, but in the next few verses we find out how wicked they were, and it seems that Judah was at least responsible for the wickedness of his two sons. He was at least in part responsible. He didn't raise them properly. They had no fear of God. And so it tells us that that he then faces some challenging consequences, heavy consequences. And these consequences, Judah loses two of his sons rather quickly. It tells us that Er was the firstborn, and Er, Judah's firstborn, verse 7, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. God said, I'm not putting up with that. And he killed him. God does practice capital punishment. That's a scary thing to think of. But that isn't the only thing. Judah tells his other son to go in and marry his wife and to give seed, and he acts as very, very evil, and God kills him. So Judah loses two sons very quickly. Then he deals with his widowed daughter in what I call some very careless conduct. He first of all puts her off, and he should have given his younger son, but he says, well, he's too young, he can't get married yet. So when he grows up, then I'll give him to you. But she waited for years, and he never intended. He kind of forgot her and let her go. And so she is left by herself. She plays the prostitute. He goes in and commits fornication to her, which is hard for us to imagine and to fathom, but he does. Gets his own daughter-in-law pregnant. Careless conduct, evil conduct, which leads to a very complicated conclusion. Shocking exposure. He says, you can read the story how she wants to make sure that she knows what she's doing. She did know what she was doing. She probably wasn't a believer. So, I mean, she still didn't have an excuse, but Judah should have known better. You don't go into a prostitute. At any rate, the whole scene, by the way, did not happen on purpose. I want you to think about this. He discovers that he got his own daughter-in-law pregnant, and then he says, you know what? She was more righteous than me. He acknowledges the fact, I was wrong. I was wrong. This whole scene, just think about this, folks, for a moment. This whole scene did not happen on purpose. Judah did not say, okay, I'm going to raise godless sons, and then I'm going to get my own daughter-in-law pregnant. He didn't think that. If you'd asked him how his life was going to go at the very beginning, he would have never dreamed of that evil. I would never do that. How do those things happen? I think Judah simply fell into multiple evils because of his lack of relationship with God. Judah is perhaps a representation of the whole clan at this point. They were so casual about their relationship with their covenant God that they all strayed and failed to experience the multiple benefits associated with his wonderful covenant. This is a picture to you and me today and a warning. When we take our Christianity for granted and practice a casual Christianity, a religion of convenience, we are in reality sliding down a dangerous slope away from God, missing his glorious blessings, and are in grave danger of committing tragic sins. And I have seen so many Christians, whether they were really saved or not, God knows. But because they didn't take their walk with God and the relationship with God seriously, they ended up in terrible circumstances. Classic illustration of what happens when we treat casually the covenant relationship we have with God. So that's human perversion and its terrible transgression. Let's move on to heaven's plot. Humans have plots, but God has a plot too. And he's training. He's training his servant for something very special. Now we pick the story back up in chapter 39. And there's something I want you to see, first of all, as we begin this chapter. It's the issue of divine presence. We saw that he went down in verse 1 to Potiphar, and he brought him in there. And it says in verse 2, that first phrase is so important, don't miss it. And the Lord was with Joseph. And he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So there's an emphasis right here at the beginning that God was with Joseph. In verse 4, Joseph found grace in the sight of his master, and he served him, and he made him overseer of his house, put all that he had into his hand. And then you know the story there. The disturbing problem hits us in verses 4 through 20. What a troubling story. What a shocking incident. Potiphar's wife comes, and she lays eyes on this handsome young man, and she wants him, and she apparently is having an affair with others, I would suppose. She was just a crude gal, and how could this happen? How could this happen if God is with Joseph? And Joseph is so pure and faithful in this situation. And he runs from this lust, or from this opportunity. And it seems, if God is really with him, that God has joined in now on this treachery, allowing Joseph to be thrown into prison. And by the way, we won't take time to look at it. There's a verse in Psalms that talks about they hurt his feet in the irons, talking about Joseph. They didn't just throw him in prison. I think they tortured him. We don't have all of the details about this, but there is no question about it. Joseph went through a horrible, horrible experience there in the dungeons of Egypt. And so there's divine presence, but there's this disturbing problem. It grates on us. How, if God is with this man, is he allowing these kinds of things? Even God joins in on the treachery. It's bad enough that his brothers do this, but God is doing this as he skillfully prepares his special servant for a glorious assignment. Folks, listen carefully. We struggle when experiencing various events in our lives of treachery and trauma, and we must learn to trust God who is with us and can use whatever we go through for his glory and for our good. Joseph didn't have that great verse in Romans 8, 28, which says, and we know, Joseph didn't know, we know that all things work together what? For good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. And we have got to take that to the bank in every situation and circumstance in our lives. Whatever it is. Divine presence, disturbing problem. Now I want to come back to this divine presence again in verses 21 through 23 because the scriptures repeat it. Look at in verse 21. Verse 21 says, but the Lord was with Joseph. There he is in that dungeon being tortured and having a difficult time and having his life wasted away. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Verse 23, and the keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made to prosper. So God was with him. God was with him. Four times this concept is repeated. This wonderful theme and emphasis must not be missed so that we learn a critical lesson. God was with Joseph, and we know that Jesus has said it to us, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. We must never forget that. Another verse that Joseph didn't have. So now let's quickly come to chapter 40 and the dream prelude, I call it. The dream prelude. Now there's some dreams here, but this is important. Understand what I'm trying to see here, what I think the text is trying to teach us. Joseph just happens, and I put that in quotes, just happens to come across two of the king's servants who got tossed into the prison. Just happens to throw them in prison, and Joseph comes across them. Yet the unmistakable reality is that God was at work behind the scenes. Joseph just happens to be assigned to put in charge of them. There's probably hundreds, maybe thousands of prisoners in this dungeon, and Joseph puts in charge of these two men. They just happen, by the way, to have simultaneous dreams on the same night. Dreams which made them both very disturbed. Can you see how all of this is just happening by chance, right? Not a chance. We know God is working behind the scenes and we can see. Joseph couldn't see that, but we can see that today. Don't miss it. The text is showing us that. Joseph encourages these men to tell their dreams to him, and he gives the inspired interpretation. God gave him that ability, don't forget. One interpretation was really, really good. The other one was very, very bad. One, he said, oh, you're gonna be taken out of prison here in 3 days, and the Pharaoh's going to raise you back up to your position. The butler, Baker, buddy, you got bad news. He's going to lift up your head, not your body. You're going to die in 3 days. And they both came true. So everybody knew this guy, when he interprets dreams, has the divine real truth. So we find out that God had given Joseph the right interpretation because the interpretations come to pass exactly as he predicted in the interpretation. And that kind of gives us a flashback to his childhood earlier, a couple of years earlier, when God had been giving these special dreams to Joseph as a child to show him the future. And so these dreams that he had as a teenager and shared with his family, we now connect the dots here. God was giving dreams back then, showing the future. God is giving dreams here and helping him to interpret them. And we discover in the next chapter that these dreams and Joseph's divine interpretation is all a prelude to the big opportunity which is about to come. But before we get to that opportunity, that we have what I call a divine pause. You know what a divine pause is? Look at the last verse here in chapter 40. Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgot him. Joseph had told that butler, he says, you're going to be raised back up into the king's thing, and when you get there, don't forget to tell the king all about me, because I am in here innocent. I did not do this, and get me out of here. And the butler, I'm sure, said, well, if that happens, I'll be sure to tell him for you. But he didn't. He forgot. We all had hope right there that this was going to happen, that the butler was going to do. That's his ticket out of prison. Not God's plan. God had something different. You know, so many times we look at life and we can see, oh, that's what God wants to do. And we figure out what we think God ought to do. But God's got a bigger and better plan, and we've got to learn to trust him. But in the meantime, this is a hard lesson for Joseph, because the next verse tells us, after 2 full years, 2 more full years stuck in that dungy dungeon, just waiting. God, what are you doing? Why is this? Perhaps he was the inspiration behind Psalm 13, which I call the How Long Song. How long, the psalmist asked the Lord, how long is this going to go on? How long? Some of you have asked questions like that. How long? The butler forgets Joseph, who continues to languish in prison. How long? His strongest and best years are being eaten away in the dungeon cell. God, do you know what you're doing? Sometimes the plan of God moves so incredibly slow that we lose hope or think God has abandoned us altogether. But like in the book of Job, God would keep his servant in the refiner's fire for the full measure of his determined time. He will come forth as purified gold. Which leads us to chapter 41 in what I call heaven's plot again, the turnaround. Turnaround. Here is the major movement here. There's a sovereign prompting in verses 1 through 8. Pharaoh has some dreams, major dreams, and they trouble him. While Joseph languished in prison, his most productive and promising years ebbing away, he is locked up. Now he's been in Egypt for 11 years. Don't lose the math. He's been in Egypt 11 full years. Years of struggle and trouble. And Pharaoh has two very disturbing nightmares. And he is summoned by Pharaoh in verses 9 and 36. The butler suddenly has a memory cord. And it just tweaks really hard. And he's there one day, and all of a sudden he's standing there and he goes, "Ah, wait a minute. There's a guy in prison. He knows how to interpret dreams." And he's watching his master that is just struggling with this. And he says, "I know somebody that might be able to help." Because Pharaoh had already asked all the magicians, all the counselors, all the wise men, and they didn't have a clue. Does this sound familiar to a scene that will come many, many years later in the capital city of Babylon, when Nebuchadnezzar had a dream and the wise men there couldn't interpret it? Only God can interpret dreams. And God gave him that dream, and God sent Daniel. Daniel perhaps studied the life of Joseph, I think. Very similar. So there's the moment of opportunity. Joseph is hastily brought before the king. He shaves, he cleans up, he puts on special clothes, and he comes before the king, and he interprets the dreams and boldly gives advice to this monarch. Boldly tells him what he needs to do. I'm telling you, that's interesting, coming out of prison and telling the king what he needs to do. But he was doing that because God had given him confidence at that time. God had prepared him for at least 11, maybe 12, 13 years there in Egypt. So he is now promoted. The servant is promoted. The man comes from the dungeon cell and he's placed up to the top of the empire. 7 or 8 years are summarized quickly to indicate Joseph's life and administration as he rules over the Egyptian empire. He gets married, he has 2 sons, and he's very successful as he builds the large grain-holding pyramids. That's right, I believe very strongly that all those pyramids in Egypt were the result of the design and the effort, the leadership of Joseph, that he is the one that got those people to build those pyramids to hold the grain. If you've ever done any study on that, nobody will claim that they know for sure, and nobody knows for sure who built them, how they got started, or anything like that. But I'll tell you what, I think it was Joseph, because there's a strong word that for the word pyramid that ties in with the word grain or granary. And that's exactly what they were built for. And so Joseph probably is the one that started those great wonders of the world. And he is building his empire. By the way, one more thing before we move on from this chapter. And I don't want to spend too much time, but I want you to just notice something. You remember what got Joseph thrown into prison? Not just his 11 brothers, but this wicked, evil wife of Potiphar, and even Potiphar himself. Did you ever think about the fact that when Joseph was raised up to the throne, he could have very quickly had both of them executed or thrown into prison? But nothing is told us about that. And I'm assuming he probably didn't do anything to that sort as well. How do I know that? Because of the way he responds to his own brothers later on. So let's quickly move on then and come to the next section, which I call a hopeful process. Chapters 42 through 45, this is testing, discovering, it's a discovery process. First of all, there's a trip to Egypt. The famine that Joseph prophesied is going to happen came after the 7 years of plenty. There's the 7 years of famine. And Joseph is now 38 years old, and he is 21 years have passed since the time that his brothers sold him into slavery into Egypt. 21 years have passed. The last time they saw him, he was a handsome young buck of 17 years old, and now he is 38, more than twice that age. They have forgotten him completely. While they may have wondered what became of their kid brother, they surely did not expect to run into him when they came down into Egypt. They're simply going to get grain. And I can imagine on their trek down there as they pass some of the fields, they're looking at all the workers and wondering, you know, I wonder if those slave workers out there, if any of them might possibly be our kid brother. You think they wondered that? And they came into the city, into the towns, and there was thousands of people, and they saw slaves around. I wondered if every once in a while they were looking just to see, is he here? Is he there? What would he look like? We don't even know what he'd look like. Finally, they come in verses 6 through 9, and they bow down to Joseph. Documentation of the dream, the first one. Remember, Joseph said, your sheaves bow down to my sheaf. What do you think we're going to do? Bow down to you? They did. They didn't know who they were bowing to, but they did. God's word always comes true. The prophecies he gives always comes true. And so that leads us to test number one in verses 9 through 20. Joseph recognizes them. They have no clue who he is because he speaks to them through an interpreter. He speaks Egyptian. They're speaking Hebrew. And he understands Hebrew very well, of course, but he doesn't want to give away who he is. So he speaks to an interpreter and he listens to them and he starts asking them, well, who are you guys? You're spies. He accuses them of being spies. Oh, no, no, no. There's an interesting key word that comes back and forth as you read all of these testing times. He calls them spies. Spies are deceived people or deceivers. They come in under the guise of being something else, but they're looking for something else. They're deceivers. He's calling them deceivers. You remember this theme of deception that's been going around through this family? You're spies. No, no, no. We're honest men, they say. We are true men. Well, how can I trust you? Well, we're the children of a man, and he's got 12 children. One is no longer living, and one stayed home with dad, and that's who we are. Now, he knew that there were 12 sons. He knew that one was still living that they thought was not living. He says, yeah, he says, you guys are spies, you're liars. No, 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 we're honest. So he's conducting a test for them. And he conducts this test of truthfulness. And he questions them hard and he forces a plan on them. And he says, I'm going to keep you in prison. He says, all right, I'll take one. He takes the oldest, Simeon, and he throws him in prison, which leads to a moment of terror. They are scared spitless. Terror from guilt, and their conscience is just crushing them. It says he bound Simeon before their eyes and they speak back and forth one to another, admitting their guilt. And they recognize this is all happening to us because of what we did to our kid brother Joseph. And they start arguing, you know, we saw the terror in his eyes. We know that he pled with us for his life. We know that we're guilty. Joseph is so taken by that, he has to get away because he's crying. This is so emotionally draining for him. They leave, and we come to test number two in chapter 43. The crisis grows. They're going to die from famine, and Jacob says, get down there. Get down and get more grain. And these brothers said, we can't do it. If we don't bring the youngest brother Benjamin with us, he will not give us grain. He will not allow us in there. Jacob said, I don't want to lose him. They argue about how they're going to do it. And finally, Judah comes up with a plan. He says, listen, I will be in his place. I will take the blame for anything. And so they go down there. And Joseph comes home and at noon. He puts up another test to him. He brings them and puts them at the table. He eats with them. And again, he puts them at a separate table and he puts them in order according to their age. That's got to scare the Beweegees out of them, whatever that is. They were, how does he know who's the oldest here? And then they watch as they kind of puts Benjamin by himself, and he puts five times as much food on Benjamin's plate as everybody else. Now, why would Joseph do that? Because he remembered so well how they treated him, the younger brother, who was doted on with favoritism. And he wanted to see their reaction when their kid brother, the youngest one that's there, was now being chosen as a favorite one, how they would react. He wanted to see if there's any jealousy in their eyes and saying, look at what they did to the kid Benjamin. He's watching like a hawk. He wants to know if they're still the same that they were with him. So then it leads to test number three. Verses chapter 44. He sets a plan up. It's a secret plant. He puts the silver cup in Benjamin's grain sack. He sends his servant after them to arrest them. They had no clue what was going on. The servant arrests them, finds the cup in Benjamin's sack, the way Joseph had it. He brings them back for a trial, and Joseph states that they may all go home, but that he would keep the young brother who had stolen the cup. Now think about this for a moment. Think about this for a moment. Joseph has created a perfect opportunity for his brothers to conveniently get rid of their other favorite son. And even this time to bear no real guilt. They didn't create this. Joseph's given them a perfect opportunity to get rid of this other kid brother now. How would they respond? He says, I will keep him. He will become my servant, my slave. And the brothers are so distraught. Finally, we have what has come up next, the great voluntary substitutionary speech. This is one of the most powerful, moving speeches in all of the Bible. And it's given by Judah. And it shows how Judah transformed from a vile pagan to somehow allowing God to work in his life, and he's a different man when he speaks here. And that speech he gives to Joseph is moving. I will take the place. Keep me instead. Let him go back. Our father will die without him. Let me take his place. I will be your servant for life. And he was basically saying, my life is yours. And they said in those days that being a slave in Egypt was like a living death. But Judah said, I will take his place. And a greater son of Judah later on came to the cross and said, I will take the place of those people there. Which leads to the chapter 45, a great trauma. Great trauma. Joseph, at this point, is convinced that something's different. These people are changed. And he reveals himself. It's a sensitive moment, emotionally charged. He's weeping. He yells out loud, I am Joseph. And these boys look up at him and they're saying, who in the world are we talking to? And they step back in horror and fear. I am Joseph. They are scared, but it becomes a very sweet moment. Compassionate, driven by divine mercy and forgiveness and the recognition of God's sovereign purpose. Joseph indicates that he has come to grips with a full understanding of God's plan here, and he has completely embraced it without any bitterness or interest of vengeance. I'm not going to take any vengeance out on you guys. God is the one that did this. I know you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And he comes to them and he takes them and he embraces them, shows them that he loves them, which leads to a trusting moment, a moment of trust in verses 16 through 28. Now they begin to trust Joseph. They travel home and they tell their father, who faints and refuses to believe it at first, but finally he accepts their report and agrees to travel to Egypt. And so these brothers come to Egypt, and there is now what I call happy progress. This is trusting. It shows that there's trusting. They're trusting Joseph, but they're trusting God too. There's a proclamation at the beginning of chapter 46, revelation, divine instructions, and God says to Jacob, go down into Egypt. There's been other times when God told Abraham, when God told Isaac, when God told Jacob, do not go down to Egypt. This time he does say, go down to Egypt and I will be with you. Then we have at the end of chapter 46, a family portrait. A portrait. Verses 8 through 27. It gives the list of all of the 12 tribes and who it is. It all comes down and gives us a list of 70 people. The children by Leah, by Zilpah, by Rachel, by Bilhah, all in separate ways. Gives the total of each of them. And there's a picture then of them, 70 people. I just want you to think in terms of, some of you have had family portraits taken before. You get together with all of your children, your grandchildren, and maybe whoever else, and you have your family portrait taken. I want you to see this as the Scripture's way to give us a family portrait of the group that goes down to Egypt. I wanted to get you a picture of our family at my parents' 60th anniversary, and then their 70th. We got the whole group together, and we got about 70 people in that group, so we're close to Abraham's clan, but we outgrew them, but then they outgrew us too. So they were started long before we were, so they're still ahead of us today. Isn't that great? But there's a precious reunion in chapter 46 where Jacob finally gets to see his son, the son that he thought for years and years, decades, he thought his son was dead and gone. Now he gets to see Joseph, and it says they both weep on each other's neck, and they embraced. Precious reunion. Then they get planted in chapter 47 in the land of Egypt. They're getting settled. They meet Pharaoh in chapter 47. And Jacob does something really strange here. He blesses Pharaoh. I wrote a little poem, didn't get it to you tonight, but there's a poem about this. He blesses Pharaoh. In the book of Hebrews, it talks about this in an interesting way, that the greater is to bless the lesser. So whoever is the greater one does the blessing. Well, here it is. Jacob blesses Pharaoh. Pharaoh's supposed to be the big honcho of the world at that time, the king of the greatest empire in that day, and yet Jacob comes in there, instead of takes a blessing from him, he blesses Pharaoh. By the way, that's an interesting picture of the fact that when God gives the promise of land, seed, and what? Blessing, God's people will be the greatest in this world, and they will be the ones that bless the world. And so that takes place there. So there's the a picture then coming of the five remaining years of famine. Joseph's power and his glory is magnified. And then there's the promise that is emphasized in chapter 47 and 48. The covenant focus on those events, land, seed, and blessing. And so it's just an awful lot of land, seed, and blessing in those chapters. And you ought to read through that circle, especially the land. We know about the seed, but the land in particular, because that seems to be the one that people struggle with the most in today's studies. There's the Ephraim and Manasseh scene at the end of chapter 48. And Jacob blesses the younger, the older two, and he switches his hands to give the greater blessing to the younger one. And Joseph didn't like that, but they forgot that Jacob was a younger child, and God is interested sometimes in those younger children. Keep that in mind. I think that God, as Isaac and Jacob, now Ephraim, God was apparently teaching them that the blessing was not an automatic. The blessing was not to be an automatic, always goes to the firstborn. What should the blessing go to? Not necessarily age or physical or earthly, but spiritual. Who's going to be the one that follows God? Who's the one that's focused on the spiritual relationship with God in the covenant? That's who's going to get the blessing. All right, so that leads us to chapter 49 in the holy prophecies. The holy prophecies, and this spells to us great truth. The period. I want you to see something in verse 49, verse 1 of chapter 49. Verse 1, and Jacob called his sons and said, gather yourselves together that I might tell you that which shall befall you when? In the last days. In the last days. So this prophecy in chapter 49 is a last days focus. We are living in the last days. And so it's important for you to recognize this time period. This prophecy is for a long way off. These prophecies look ahead to the destinies of each tribe in the end. Now the prophecies from verses 3 through 27, they go from oldest to youngest, and they build off of their actions and their reputations. You look at every one of them, and Joseph talks about how these actions took place. If you want to do a very interesting study and read about this, John Phillips, in his commentary, it's in the library, he wrote a brilliant description of how this took place. It's amazing to see this. God works through Father Jacob to talk to each one of his sons and said, this is what you've done, and this is the future for you. This is how you acted, this is the future for you. This is what you did, this is your future. And he comes to Judah, and there's a very special blessing and prophecy given to Judah. There's a special focus on this. And Judah, it tells us in verse 8, is going to be the king. It's from his tribe that the king is going to come. The scepter holder will always be from this tribe. He'll be the lawgiver that indicates divinity. God is the lawgiver. And he will, when Shiloh comes, Shiloh was a messianic term. And he says, until the gathering of the people, he says there in verse 10. Verse 10 is a powerful verse that pictures the coming of Messiah, Jesus Christ. And so it pictures the gathering of the people, pictures obedient following in the millennial kingdom. Alan P. Ross says, this prophecy pivots on the word until. When the promised one who will rule the nations appears, the scene, he says, will become an earthly paradise. These verses anticipate the kingship in Judah culminating in the reign of Messiah, the tribe of Judah, in which the nations will obey him. So then we have the promise in verses 28 through 33, the conclusion. Before dying, Jacob tells them where to bury him. He says, bury me up in the land, the promised land. It's talking about the future. Like grandfather Abraham and father Isaac, Jacob held to the special covenant with dying faith. I want to be buried in the promised land, looking forward to this fulfillment when you give us this land. Which leads us to the final chapter, heaven's purpose, and that is triumph. Heaven's purpose. Once again, there is a powerful emphasis upon the covenant which God has repeatedly communicated throughout the four generations from Abraham to Joseph. The covenant, the covenant, the covenant, the covenant. Don't forget the promise. Land, seed, blessing. There's a funeral procession, verses 1 through 13. They take a large group. I'll tell you what, it is a huge group that goes up there. A lot of the king's guard and the servants and the families. I'm telling you what, it could have been at least a couple thousand went up there. Then there's a funeral postlude in verse 14 to 21. Look at this. There's a wearied return in verse 14. Notice what it says. And Joseph returned into Egypt, he and his brethren, and all that went up with him to bury his father, and he buried his father. I remember when we buried my father. There was a huge amount of details to get through, get ready and through that funeral. And when we finally got through it, we all came back and had a meal together. And it was a long trek, and you think an awful lot about your life and the future. So it's a wearied return. Anyone who's buried their father or mother, you know how there is a weariness when it's over. And then the long trek home for Joseph and his brothers. There is relief for sure. And yet we will see in the next verse what was on the mind of his brothers all the way back to Egypt. And that's where we come to this worried request. Look at it in verse 15. And when Joseph's brethren saw that his father was dead, they said, Joseph will perhaps hate us and will certainly requite us all the evil which we did unto him. And they sent a messenger unto Joseph, saying, thy father did command before he died, saying, so shall we say to Joseph, forgive, I pray now, the trespass of thy brethren and their sin, for they did unto thee evil, and now we pray thee, forgive the trespass of thy servants of the God of thy father. And Joseph wept when they spoke unto him. This worried request. They had made an amazing visit to the promised land. They were all children of the promise. But they worried about Joseph getting revenge on them. When you hate, and they hated their brother, you expect people to hate you back. And they were fearful. Notice the wonderful response of Joseph in verse 19 through 21. And Joseph said unto them in verse 19, fear not, For am I in the place of God? But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good to bring to pass as it is this day to save many people alive. Now therefore, fear not. I will nourish you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly unto them. What a wonderful response. What a wonderful indication that Joseph had learned that God was in charge of this whole thing. Joseph had learned the plan of God and how he can turn all human treachery into blessing. Furthermore, this pictures how God will eventually turn all the world's treacherous plots against Israel into a wonderful ending. Which leads us to the final picture. Verse 22, and Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's house, and Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children, and of the third generation, the children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were brought up upon Joseph's knees. You see the picture of this old grandpa, great-grandpa, dandling his grandkids on his knees in a rocking chair. It pictures how all believers should face their approaching death with confidence in God's promises. Joseph is so confident that he wants his remains to be transported and buried into the promised land. And that's what we find in verses 24 and 25. We've got the happy ending in verses 22 and 23. Notice the holy expectation, verse 24 and 25. Joseph said in verse 24, thus said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land unto the land which he swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. So Joseph is so confident of that, notice what he does in verse 25. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones from here. God is going to take you out of Egypt and bring you to the land, the promised land. I want you to take my bones and bury me there. And we conclude with a humble epitaph in verse 26. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. 110 years old, they embalmed him. Kind of a picture of what goes on in our funeral processions today. I think, by the way, I've looked at this chapter. It gives us a clue as to how we ought to look at funerals. And people sometimes ask me, you know, should we do a cremation? I say, well, they didn't back then because God valued the body. Treat the body, even though the soul is gone, treat the body with great respect. Did you see those last words there? A coffin in Egypt. The final words of Genesis. Think about that. Coffin, death, Egypt. All these seem to be the opposite of land, seed, and blessing. The Abrahamic covenant was supposed to blossom in his descendants. But they are not in the land, and one of the most promising stars, Joseph, ends up being buried in Egypt, not in the land. But the seed has been buried, and it will spring to life as we open the next chapter. God has promised, and it will come to pass. Never doubt his word. Let's conclude with some application. Number one, trust God's promises. Trust God's promises. He's made a lot of promises in here. Do you know how many times the Abrahamic covenant is referenced here in Genesis? By the way, it will continue to be referenced in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and all through the Old Testament. All through the Old Testament. As I said, the Abrahamic covenant is like that tent peg, the beam that holds up the whole circus tent. And the whole Old Testament kind of builds off of that great Abrahamic covenant, land, seed, blessing. God has made some promises. He made them to Abraham. They came true. He makes promises to us. We can believe his promises. Secondly, trust God's plan for your life. Trust God's plan for your life and for this whole world. We look at this world being so messed up. There, we take another nation's president out, and there's wars all over the place, and things are just going haywire, it seems like, all over the planet. God has said it would be like that in the last days. We can trust God. He's made the plan. We know what's coming. We can trust Him. And you can trust Him with your life. When things don't go as you would like, when you don't think that God's watching or cares about you, think again. Read the book of Genesis. Read the life of Joseph. God is with you if you're one of His children. He's watching you. He will discipline if He needs to. He will comfort you. He will help you. He will strengthen you. And He will be there for you. Trust God's plan. Don't try to manipulate your way around and do it your way. All these guys try to do it their way. Trust God's plan. And finally, forgive others and let God minister vengeance. Don't you worry about getting even. Don't you try to do that. Just learn how to forgive. Learn how to forgive and trust God to take care of that vengeance problem. He is the one that can take care of it all. We can trust Him for that. I've seen so many people that allow their lives to be ruined by bitterness. They haven't learned to forgive. They can't let go. They are the ones that want to do vengeance on others. Learn to trust God. Careless seems the great avenger. History's pages but record. One death grappled in the darkness twixt the old systems and the word. Truth forever on the scaffold. Wrong forever on the throne. Yet the scaffold sways the future, and behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch upon His own. I don't think we see that more thrilling in any other person as much as Joseph. God is there keeping His eye on this man, and He's got His eye on you, and so you can trust Him.